The next case on our calendar is 99-270 Michael Oker versus Ameritech Corporation. Justice Resnick has recused herself on this case. We have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Judith Chrisley, who is the judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 11th District. Welcome back. Courts.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. There is no justice or policy reason to deprive Mike Oker of his day in court for filing an age discrimination case within 6 months of termination of his employment and within 3 months of the hiring of his much younger replacement. Yet, the defendant here seeks to accomplish this result by taking advantage of an absurdly short statute of limitations, an artificial termination and rehire of the company's lawyers, and a three-month delay in the hiring of Mr. Oker's replacement.
Counsel, if we ran the statute from the date of his last employment, would you do that okay?
Yes. Yes, his last day of employment as a lawyer was January 8th, and the lawsuit was filed on June 29th.
And Dr. Patient's situation,
yes, Your Honor. A much closer analogy is the Lordstown School District case, in which this court decided in a teacher case that the teacher notified prior to April 30th that her contract would not be renewed, that the statute nonetheless runs from the last date of the contract, the end of employment on August 31st. And that seems to me clear, a clear precedent which this decision below flies in the face of.
Mr. Schwartz, you've argued this point, but I'd like to hear you argue it here. We're not bound, certainly, by federal law on this issue, it seems to me the federal statute, federal law seems to be that when a person is advised that they're going to be terminated, the statute begins to run. Why should we not just adopt the federal law so we're consistent with, assuming that that's your interpretation of the law?
Well, because to the extent that it's true, the federal system is not the same as our system. Under the Ohio scheme, there is a claimant has an option, a choice, has to elect between proceeding through the administrative agency or proceeding to court under the two statutes that provide for direct court action. When the plaintiff files his action directly in court, he's required to comply with the requirements of Rule 11 and to have a viable case on filing. If he chooses to go to the Ohio Civil Rights Commission, he's then barred from proceeding in court. On the federal side, however, it's very different. The Federal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, procedure is a mandatory prelude to court action and doesn't bar one from court action. One can file his EEOC complaint without having to meet Rule 11 on a hunch, suspicion, probable cause, scintilla, and then not be faced with the statute of limitations problem until after the EEOC has addressed it. And that seems to me to be, in addition to this court's long chain of decisions of this court holding that when the conduct becomes presently injurious, when the statute begins to run, it's also a policy and a reasoned basis, a rational basis for having a different rule in Ohio than you have in the federal system.
Here.
In your scenario, if a woman is at a law firm and she doesn't make partner, and the partner says, we don't want to move another law firm, she works there another 5 years, and she has those 5 more years to
probably not. The reason being that when she is told that, she has at that point a prima facie case that she can walk into court with without having to be concerned about the Rule 11 implications of it. in addition, you've got this 5-year postponement, and that makes that case look more like the federal case involving the tenure situation, where a professor is told that he's being denied tenure years before his employment comes to an end. There are a number of alternative ways of addressing this case. One is, as your first question pointed out, that if you run the statute from his last day of employment, he's filed within it. Secondly, there is the presently injurious rule of prior cases. Third, on a discovery rule basis, what you have here is a prima facie case established under McDonnell Douglas and Parker versus Scoville, this court's adoption of it.
Those are discharge cases, though, aren't they, counsel?
This is a discharge case, too.
That's what I'm wondering. That I thought we should get that straight out.
Sure.
Because you argue it in your brief as if it is a discharge case. And when does the discharge take place? I mean, if it is a discharge, because it seems like his gripe is, I wasn't selected, and then thus it would be a refusal to hire. But if it is a discharge...
The discharge took place on January 8th, when his last day of employment as an attorney. Although this is close...
Even though everybody else, you know, because we know the difference where a plant closing, you know, is this... This is distinguishable where they say we're no longer going to have a department and every lawyer is let go, except those who are chosen for the new job.
But that's only de jure. De facto, what really happened here is that simply the functions were transferred by the parent company, which controlled all of this and did all of the decision making. This wasn't two independent entities in which one closed down and he was terminated and then he was given the opportunity to apply to an independent entity for another job. In reality, these lawyers simply were transferred from one payroll to the other. The other ones continued doing the same work in the same place for just a different company in name than the one they had been working for before.
I was going that way, but I thought your client testified that he wasn't bringing a discharge case, that he knew that he knew at the time he was told by Chicago that he wasn't selected, that right then he knew that that was based on age, and that the department really was disbanded. It seemed to me his testimony was the opposite of what you're saying, and he said he wasn't even bringing that an action for the discharge.
Well, at the time of that event, he wasn't fully apprised of all the circumstances. He didn't know when they had been asking people, his colleagues, if you had to choose between Bettendorf and Oker, which one would you choose? He didn't know that they really had reserved 3 slots on the chart, and it wasn't necessary to choose between Bettendorf and Oker. And he was led to believe until April 11, when he found out that they had hired a woman 16 years younger to replace him, that this was a downsizing from 3 to 2, and that's a different, totally different legal proposition. And the problem you're faced with here is that the decision below puts the Ohio employment lawyer in an impossible position vis-a-vis Rule 11. Either he has to violate Rule 11 by filing an action in which he doesn't yet have the elements of a prima facie case.
If it is a discharge, because if he says it was discriminatory to not select him, then the hiring of the gal 4 months later, younger woman, doesn't bear on the failure to select him. Does it? Maybe you'd help prove it that way, but the PFC is on the date that he was notified that choice was made, you're not our guy.
It does, because it's really an artificial distinction to divide this into 2 processes, and that's what the company is seeking to do in order to immunize itself. And And frankly, what this would permit under the present 6-month statute of limitations on age discrimination cases, what this would be permit is advise the man three months ahead of time that he's going to be let go, wait 3 months to hire his replacement, and avoided judicial scrutiny under the Barker versus Scope.
Mr. Schwartz, I understand your argument with regard to January 8th, particularly the fact that he wouldn't have known even then that he was going to be terminated on January 8th because they had continued that from December 31.
Right, there was a second notice, in fact, and the first notice wasn't the operative.
So,
right.
So what I'm saying is I understand that argument, but I'd like to know, does the sun ever set on the period, on the discovery rule? If you want to apply a discovery rule in this context, what if they had waited for a longer period of time, then decided they needed somebody else and hired somebody else? Does the statute start to run then?
Well, if you look at the court's jurisprudence on the discovery rule, where it applies, the sun doesn't set until the murderer is convicted or the doctor advises the patient that
the device is
caused by exposure to a noxious substance. And the significant fact here is we're talking about a factor which is wholly within control of the defendant, of the employer.
Okay, so the answer to my question is, in your judgment then, if they replaced him 3 years later with somebody not from the protected class, the cause of action is then accrues.
That's right.
How would we ever keep track of all that?
The same way you keep track of the discovery rule in all other cases where it applies.
You're talking about Gaines versus preterm and
right.
Those kinds of
Gaines versus preterm is interesting. That's an equal protection case comparing someone who discovers the operative facts at the time with someone who doesn't. There's another equal protection case here, frankly. 6 months for age discrimination and 6 years for race and sex.
That's your fourth argument.
I can't think of a single rational basis for differentiating a statute of limitation of 6 months for age and 6 years for race and sex. And yet that's the current state of the law.
So you're claiming that statute is unconstitutional as a fourth argument?
Yes.
On the basis that it doesn't meet a rational basis test?
That's right.
That was argued at the Court of Appeals.
The equal protection argument was argued at the Court of Appeals. It was argued based on...
It's not in the decision. I didn't know. I didn't see it in the decision from the Court of Appeals, that argument.
Gaines versus...
Gaines is in there.
Gaines versus preterm, I believe, was argued.
Yes, that's in there. Could I ask one other question? What is the discriminatory act of which your client complained?
In the Lordstown case, the court defines the discriminatory act as to be when the damage sets in. And if I could quote for you exactly from that. Apparently don't have the case up here with me.
Wouldn't it have to either be the firing? I mean, if it's a discharge. Well, if it's a discharge, it's got to be. Oh, it doesn't have to be the day you fire. It can be the last day that you got paid.
The last day of employment. The cause of action doesn't accrue until damage starts to sit in. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you.
My name is Robert Wolf, and I represent the athlete in this case. Initially, I would like to point out that the issue of the constitutionality of 41-1202 and the 6 months versus the 6 years is not raised as a proposition of law in this case. It does not read below. And I surely think that an issue of such statewide importance should not be decided by this court without an opportunity to brief. I do not think that issue is properly before you. I think that it is one thing to make characterizations of the evidence regarding whether this was a failure to select case or whether this was a termination case, but I would rather refer the justices of this court to the actual record that was developed below. There was discovery in Cleveland and Chicago, from the general counsel of Meritech down to fellow attorneys. Both sides did a very vigorous job of uncovering the relevant facts. And not only did they not establish that this was not a real failure to hire case of a distinct entity making that decision, the evidence not overwhelmingly informally established just the opposite.
Failure to hire? I didn't think it was a failure to hire. They're claiming discharge.
Your Honor, in the...
They're different.
In the complaint, they talk about a discharge. In discovery, we learned, and Mr. Ofer testified, that prior to being told he wouldn't be hired, he was totally insulated from Meritech Chicago, page 146 in his deposition. This was a real application. He gave references. He was interviewed, albeit not a satisfactory interview from his point of view. His references were counted.
You're talking about the 12-minute interview.
Yes, I'm talking about that. All of Ohio Bell's attorneys went off payroll, in fact, at the beginning of 1995, as Mr. Ofer's deposition at page 255, the large share of what Meritech, the business units were doing in Ohio were things that had never been done by Ohio Bell. That's Mr. Ofer's testimony in 264 of his deposition. His client, prior, always, no exceptions, so testified Mr. Ofer, and then Ohio Bell. His application to work for Meritech was rejected on 11-9-94. He testified under oath that if he had any continuing employment with this entity, it would be with the Meritech Corporation and he would be reporting to new folks in Chicago. He had been reporting to a general counsel at Ohio Bell, who also was. And was transferred to Chicago, in fact. Mr. Ofer knew at that time his application was rejected, his words, little room for doubt, his deposition at page 381. 6 days later, he requested a transfer to a customer service representative to maximize, as he had every right to do, his payout benefit. That's his deposition at 428. And at that time, he believed with certainty, and he, ladies and gentlemen, was a litigator with an employment litigation, that this was part of the corporate policy of America out of Chicago to discriminate against older employees. That's his deposition, page 418. He just has no proof of that fact. And that we argued on the merits as part of the Court of Appeals. They ruled on the statute of limitations argument that we also argued.
I'm still not sure when you opened. Were you saying that you view this as a failure to fire case?
I do indeed. A failure to select.
So I thought you said it's just the other way around.
But if I did, shame on me. This is a failure to select case. Everybody lost their jobs. Wisconsin Bell, Ohio Bell, Indiana Bell, Michigan Bell. I'm leaving Bell out.
So when a company is purchased and subsumed by another corporation, and people working for the acquired entity are discharged, it is simply that they were not employed by the new corporate entity. Is that the way it works?
Justice Pfeiffer, no. I would suggest you have to look at the facts and the record developed by the counsel in each case. And if one company comes in and discriminatorily lets a variety of people go, and there is some discriminatory element to that act, then no, that would be the discriminatory act, as in Lordstown, when a contract automatically would have renewed, but for an allegedly discriminatory decision not to renew the contract, which directly led to loss of employment.
Okay, well, I guess I'm confused about how this whole corporate world works. So, when there's an acquisition of an ongoing entity, everybody still has their job, or not?
I can only tell you how it worked here. Everyone in the legal department lost their job, regardless of age, regardless of race.
But that's not a termination.
No, that was not a discriminatory act, Your Honor. there's no way, I mean, no theory pursuant to which that false report exists.
Let's not deal with discrimination first. The act of losing your job, that's not, discrimination is a failure to hire.
I'm not being personal, let me try again. Losing your job, it's, nobody's denying that to juries. Nobody's denying it to Mr. Oker and the others who lost their jobs. But to be injurious isn't the only part of the test that this court has applied. Every statute of limitations decision that I'm aware of being decided, it has to be presently injurious based upon some wrongful conduct of the defendant.
Your point is that this termination doesn't matter unless it's an unlawful termination.
Exactly.
That termination is a lawful job, but the query is why was the termination done?
The issue is what is the alleged unlawful or discriminatory act that Mr. Oker challenged in this case?
I think we're tiptoeing around the issue of whether the need for a prima facie case before you can file. And the question I think comes up, is this a matter of being unable to establish a cause of action to survive a dismissal action response? Or is it merely a matter of, did you indicate evidence, or if you want to further than that, matters that they shifted the burden of proof in an existing case?
Your Honor, I think it's certainly the matter of evidentiary presentation. This court has held, in the Malley opinion, that the plaintiff's burden is to come forward with the initial burden of offering evidence adequate to create an inference that the employment decision was illegal, and I'm quoting, the decision making was done by evidence of any kind. More recently, I guess plurality of justices in the Byrne decision said, and I quote again, evidence of any nature to show that the employment decision, more likely than not, was motivated by age. There has never been a suggestion by this court, ever, that you are limited to direct evidence, somebody saying, I'm letting you go because of your age,
okay.
or a prima facie case.
If he had had timely evidence of the hiring of a younger person, so that was not an issue here, if he didn't have this, could he still go forward with other evidence indicating there was a game plan to eliminate other employees? Or did he have to show that a younger person was hired to make a case that had to survive the connection?
Not only did he not have to show that, McDonnell Douglas, Baker Scoville case, he doesn't mention that he was involved by a candidate. He certainly has argued that.
So prima facie case simply means that the burden shifts to the employer to show that there wasn't some other explanation. If there's not a prima facie case, the burden simply remains with him to show through other kinds of evidence that in fact discrimination exists.
I agree. All the sorts of evidence that we see Able Claims Council relying on all the time. It can be statistical, it can be competently situated individuals. These statements that were made, the decisions involving other employees, there is not a suggestion that you can do with this court that you either need to foil a prima facie case or you're violating Rule 11. If you say Mr. Oker did his complaint, although he couched the determination, which we think the record indicates this is not that kind of case, but that it was on account of his age, he doesn't even plead like a prima facie case. If this isn't that he has exposure, case with a delayed illness like Burgess, it's not a delayed illness of asbestos exposure like in Sturker, it's not delayed knowledge of contamination in a building, asbestos removal like the NPR case, it's not a doc leaving an IUD in and lying to the patient about it like Ames and Preterm, it's not conversion of a factory many years after the statute ran, and only at that point the defect is discovered and somebody dies on the president.
Let me get to what this case is. Well, we find in the record, Mr. Schwartz has argued that Ameritech and Ohio Bell really were, for all purposes here, were really one and the same. Will we find in the record any evidence on that will tell us whether this is a, I have the same question that Justice Cook had, is this a discharge case or a failure to hire case? It seems to me it's a failure to hire case. If instead of Ameritech, this is Sprint, who was doing the interviews and deciding whom to hire of the, who's the lawyers who've been let go by Ohio. So the record help us with that?
I think the record will help you in terms of understanding this is like to sign this commission that all of the decisions about retention, non-retention, about hire, non-hire of attorneys for this new entity were made in Chicago. I think that coupled with Mr. Over's testimony that he always worked for Ohio Bell, he always reported to general counsel from Ohio Bell, and that he knew that he had no longer any responsibilities with Ohio Bell after November 11th. Answers that question, Your Honor, as to who made the decision to abolish all of the legal positions in the Baby Bells, the State Bells, that's not in the record. I think we can assume that the Ohio Law Department didn't decide to disband itself. But I think the issue then becomes, is there any possible cause of action that could flow from the decisions to abolish all positions?
The other question is, who made the decisions to hire and not hire? If those are decisions made by a separate entity, totally separate entity, Bell, then we have a different case than the discharge case?
I'm sorry.
Then it's not a discharge case, is it?
I believe it's not. It is unrebutted in this Lichtenstein data, which we have to supplement. This is what we're reviewing, that the hire, not hire decisions are made exclusively by the associate general counsels and Ms. Lichtenstein, who was head of the general litigation practice group in Chicago. None of these were individuals that Mr. Overing ever reported to. His deposition exhibits that are also in your appendix make clear he would report to Mr. Carson, who is the general counsel of Ohio Bell. And he testified very clearly under oath, my client has always been Ohio Bell. And I have another American deficit So I don't see, I see that it's a very important issue when I hear characterizations from opposing counsel, but I don't think there's record evidence to
counsel the. The entity here was when it started out that these lawyers were Ohio Bell. And they were headquartered where?
They were headquartered in
Cleveland. And when Meritech acquired its headquartered in Chicago,
yes.
And the lawyers, assuming these newly defined roles, were headquartered. Where did they go to work?
The employers that we are discussing and which reflect state where they were. However, the record also reflects that the nature of the practice changed. A lot of work was outsourced in the recovery of the workers' comp, that was outsourced in quadro domestic relations orders.
So it's the same law office in the same building. That's the same lawyers were going to work. And the new corporation is involved in a heavily regulated industry in the state of Ohio.
Less so than it has been in the past.
Okay, so this, the degree of regulation didn't change with the acquisition. It's still the phone business subject to the regulation of the Public Utilities Commission in the state of Ohio before and after the acquisition.
Yes and no, Your Honor. There's still the phone business, but the record also reflects, and Mr. Ogre testified to this, that Ameritech, through a part of this reorganization, has various enhanced business units, Ameritech Security, Ameritech Cellular, business units that were conducting business totally foreign to anything that had ever been done by Ohio Bell, but the network business is still being done in Ohio, obviously.
And while that being less regulated, the degree of regulation is not changing due to the merger, it's changing due to changes in the law.
Counsel, when do you say the statute began to run?
The statute began to run, Justice, when Mr. Over was told unequivocally, this a group of associate general counsel was dispatched from Chicago to personally meet with him on November 9th, 1994. They sat down, they said, we're sorry, Mike, there's not going to be a position for you with Ameritech. He testified that left no room for doubt. He knew he would not have future employment. That, you know, the statute began to run just as the individual decided partnership. The statute begins to run with the managing partner, his or her, his or her office, and says, I'm sorry, partner. And just like the race can't
stand. And did they cease of being paid on that date?
No.
Why was that?
Because they were to trying to give a drover an opportunity to get on with his life, and they wanted to keep him on family. It was for good, not bad reasons.
So it was gratuitous upon the company that they kept him on the payroll so he would have money coming in, but he wasn't working for them.
Correct. He testified that he was told at that time.
He was working.
It's time for you to start figuring out what you're going to do. The record reflects he did a couple of things. Number one, he realized that
Did they tell them when this gratuitous salary was going to end?
They said it would be, I believe, September 31st, and then it was another date.
January 8th.
And then it was January 8th.
Yes,
so the last payment that they received gratuitously was on January 8th.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, then he went to a service representative job, which allowed him to increase his payout.
But he was terminated on 11-9-94?
No, he was told he would not be selected for a position in Maritech. He, along with all other Ohio Bell lawyers in the five-state region,
It's 11-9-94.
Is when he was told he was not in a position.
And you say that's when he had noticed, or the damages began to run, that we calculate the statute on.
Yes, particularly given the fact that the statute gives you emotional distress damages, particularly given the fact that the fund litigation testified with absolute certainty that there was a culmination of 5 years of employees. That is on the
statute. Thank you.
He was told, I assume, by Maritech representatives from Chicago that he was not going to be employed by them. And he was told by them that he would be kept on Ohio Bell's payroll for a period of time. Does the record indicate why they had the authority to tell him that? And it does, but they're two separate independent companies, I guess. I wonder
with that gratuitous to be paid here from
Maritech. He tell it well, just so Ohio Bell's going to keep going on the payroll. Communications they worked it out.
Just where it was clearly apparent in the city or situation. We're not contending here that Ohio Bell was an equal partner in any sense. They were owned by Maritech.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Schwartz, you saved a little over a minute of your time.
These were not two independent companies. Ohio Bell, Ameritrust Ohio, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Ameritrust. Ameritrust called all the shots, abolishing the jobs, rehiring, terminating. And the fact that you fire everybody and then rehire only the white people shouldn't get you off the hook for the discriminatory decision made in the termination. I agree with Mr. Wolf that we did not argue the 6 months versus 6 years equal protection in the Court of Appeals. We did argue the gains versus pre-term between those who discovered in time and those who didn't in the Court of Appeals. The McDonnell-Hopkins formulation, if there are two ways to make a prima facie case. One is with evidence of directly of age discrimination. The other is by the McDonnell-Hopkins-Barker formulation. The reason for the McDonnell-Hopkins-Barker formulation is to give the plaintiff an alternative way because he frequently doesn't have the evidence in order to make the proof on the issue directly. And that's the case we have here. Indeed, Mr. Wolf trumpets loudly throughout the entire case at every level, including this court, how Mr. Oker had no evidence of age discrimination, no direct evidence of age discrimination. What he had is evidence that he was qualified, that he was hired to, that he was fired, that he was replaced by a younger worker, and that the explanations given an alleged non-discriminatory reason are pretextual, and there's overwhelming evidence for that proposition. Indeed, Ohio lawyers faced with this problem, the practical problem in intake, making a decision up front whether to take the case or not. I would never have taken this case or filed this lawsuit if I couldn't have alleged, as I did in paragraph 9, that defendant removed plaintiff from his attorney position because of his age, 52 at the time of removal, and hired a 36-year-old attorney to replace him after allowing him to be misleading him into believing that this was part of a reduction in force or downsizing.
Second. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.